It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says lawmakers need to look at new ways to raise money to put toward transportation funding in Wisconsin.
First, there was a new legal development about the status of grandparents and other relatives in President Trump's travel ban today. We'll get the latest.
And as the GOP health care bill continues to face roadblocks, there's growing pressure on Republicans to pass a budget plan that the party agrees on.
You can share your thoughts on either of those topics at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ginger Gibson joins us now to talk about that and more for our regular week in Washington. Ginger, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Supreme Court gave the Trump administration today more room to enforce parts of the travel ban. What do we know about this one paragraph order today?
Right. The Supreme Court is saying they can move forward with enforcement, but they must have a more expanded definition of family, which would include grandparents. The initial decision from the administration said that you could come into the country if you were one of those countries that you had established ties to the country, to somebody already here. But they didn't include grandparents, and there's a lot of opposition to that. Point saying that grandparents clearly are a close part of a family, and as a result, we know now that the administration is likely to start letting grandparents in with those with ties.
Well, there is also another part of this paragraph on refugees associated with a resettlement agency to enter the U.S. And the decision was an appeal of a lower court decision last week. Talk about the refugee part of this.
We know that the courts are weighing how much access for refugees, and I have to be honest with you, I'm not terribly familiar with the exact details of this, what it means for refugees, but we do know that there's a lot of groups that are making the case that these resettlement nonprofits that exist that are designed just to help refugees resettle should be considered one with ties. It's because these groups are allowing them to, are giving them a place to live and a place to work and helping them find services. And so they're not just coming here without some type of aid and assistance already established.
What does this say about where the Supreme Court is with this travel ban, with its newest member on the bench, Neil Gorsuch?
You know, it's always unwise to try to read the tea leaves of the Supreme Court. They've often surprised people what they thought was going one way and ultimately went another. But we do take this as an indication that they may be inclined to let this travel ban go forward in some form, but not maybe in as broadly as the White House would have liked, maybe some middle ground. The addition of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court was another reliably conservative voice on the court, and one would suggest that he would be willing to side with this administration on this issue.
Well, let's move on now to the GOP budget plan. President Trump promised to keep entitlement programs in place. What exactly would the latest GOP budget do to things like Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security?
So it's important to remember that budget plans are not spending plans. So they're sort of high-level thoughts about what someone might like to see done to some government program. And we know from past budgets from the Republican Party and the most recent budgets we see coming out, they're still looking at making big changes to what they call entitlement programs. They would like to see Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid all drastically overhauled. They think that these programs are not fiscally sound and that they're costing the federal government too much. Trump has said that he wouldn't touch these programs, that he thinks that they're not fair to touch. We saw a little bit of that trying to work around by his administration, saying that they would address Social Security disability benefits, but not Social Security benefits for the elderly. That might be a distinction without a difference. It's still Social Security, but it's different populations. So we see the Republican Party still looking at ways that they can go after these programs, still looking at ways they can find savings. And in this budget, looking at billions of dollars in savings through these programs and tasking the committees of jurisdiction to go in and make those reductions.
Do you see nuances in this House 2018 fiscal year budget plan that looks for ways to put some tax cuts into motion?
Absolutely. I spoke with Kevin Brady, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, this morning, and he told me that Republicans are considering this budget the tax reform budget. They think this is the budget to get tax reform done. There's a bit of a parliamentary rules workaround where if they put tax reform into the budget, they can avoid needing any Democratic votes. They can do it with just Republican votes. And that's what they're looking to do in this document, trying to use it as sort of a get-out-of-bipartisanship card to enable them to pass an overhaul of the tax code with only Republican votes.
The Senate health care bill fell through again this week. Does that put additional pressure on conservatives to pass a budget?
There's a lot more pressure because the health care bill fell through. Lawmakers in Congress are looking at the last 7 months and seeing that they've gotten, well, nothing done that they said they were going to do. And when you get 7 months into the year, you start thinking about the next year. And the next year is an election year. And they want to go home and tell their voters that they got something accomplished. And when they can't pass the repeal of the ACA, which is something they all campaigned on, tax reform starts to look like something that must get done in order to say they've reached some accomplishments. The budget becomes the vehicle, the way that they can try to get that done. But it shouldn't be underestimated. Many of the problems that have made health care impossible to pass are going to be issues when they start taking up tax reform.
And this this budget plan, it does really target the safety net programs with cuts, and there are trillions of dollars in cuts over a decade. It also boosts military spending and defense spending. How have Democrats reacted to it?
I mean, Democrats have what they think is the perfect attack plan here. They're going to be able to say Republicans want to cut the social safety net in order to cut taxes for the rich. Now, Republicans will come back and say, we're not cutting the social safety net. We're making it work better and spending less money. And we're not cutting taxes for the rich. We're making jobs. But I think that for Democrats who want to paint Republicans as not caring about the middle class, they see this as the perfect opportunity. There's a lot to be criticized there, and it's always going to be difficult to make any cuts or changes to those social safety net programs. One can put in a budget that they would like to only spend $10 on going out to dinner next month, but when it gets down to the actual appropriating process, which in Congress is done in a separate process, sometimes even the average person will find that that budget that they aspire to is not something that they can live with. And that's repeatedly what's happened when Congress has tried to address cuts to the social safety net in the budget process. They've found they just don't, even among Republicans, have the votes to actually pull the trigger on those cuts.
Talking right now with Ginger Gibson, who is a political correspondent at Reuters, about the top news of the week in Washington. Ginger, is there traction right now on Capitol Hill for repeal and not replacing Obamacare?
It looks like that proposal that Mitch McConnell had seemed to float earlier this week was dead on arrival. Several Republicans, including Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, were quite clear that voting for a straight repeal bill was a no-go, that they would not support that. And the Republicans' control of the Senate is so narrow that losing two causes a tie that would have to be broken by Vice President Mike Pence. But we also know that we've got one member out sick, and they could easily lose a third on a straight repeal vote. But it seems that that is not a realistic option. We may see the Senate still vote on it. They have said that they could move forward with a vote just to show that the support's not there and to make people put their names down next to one side or another. But it looks increasingly unlikely that they would be able to accomplish a straight repeal, even as we've seen them hold meetings today in Washington to discuss that topic.
And what is the sentiment then coming out of Mitch McConnell? What is he saying, telling reporters?
Mitch McConnell seems to be determined to get something done. He's got to deal with a lot of different parts of his caucus, people who have very different views. The Ted Cruz's and Susan Collins of the world view this very differently. I suspect that what Mitch McConnell really wants to do is move forward on tax reform. He sees that something is having a lasting impact and really helping drive the economy. I think if it were up to him, they would drop health care and move on to taxes and then maybe come back to health care later. But he seems at least interested in making sure that they stabilize the market, and it's likely that we'll see Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander start to try to negotiate bipartisan options to make sure that the health insurance market is stabilized.
We're recapping the top political stories of the week from Washington with Ginger Gibson. She's a political correspondent at Reuters.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or on the Central Time Facebook page. What are your thoughts on the GOP budget plan so far, which would make cuts to Medicaid and Social Security, among other things? And tell us what you think about the president's decision to recertify the Iran nuclear deal, a deal he was a vocal critic of not too long ago. Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back in a moment here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're picking up the conversation now with Ginger Gibson, political correspondent at Reuters, and we're recapping the top stories in national politics.
And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the president's decision to recertify the Iran nuclear deal? Are you happy with the negotiations President Trump is making and his foreign policy so far? And you can also share your thoughts on Donald Trump Jr.'s unreported meeting with a Russian lawyer that made headlines last week. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ginger, President Trump recertified the Iran nuclear deal, which he really rallied against on the campaign trail. And let's take a listen to some examples.
The deal is one of the worst negotiated deals of any kind that I've ever seen.
This is one of the worst deals ever made by any country in history. The deal with Iran will lead to nuclear problems. All they have to do is sit back 10 years, and they don't have to do much, and they're going to end up getting nuclear.
The Iranians are very good negotiators. The Persians are always great negotiators. They are laughing at us back in Iran.
So why would he reapprove this deal?
I think Donald Trump got into office and realized a little bit of the realities of inheriting things that you just can't change by yourself. For starters, this is not a unilateral deal between the United States and Iran. It was a deal that was struck between the U.S. and several major powers in Europe, which means if the Europeans continue to certify this deal, the United States is going to look like it's the one that's breaking the agreement. When Germany and the Brits say Iran's doing everything they agreed to do, and Iran says we're doing everything we agreed to do, and then Donald Trump says, no, you're not, I don't like it, I'm getting rid of it, that's a difficult case to make, and it's going to be one that I think he's dealing with the realities of. Additionally, he may have to show evidence that they were violating the deal if he's going to be able to convince people that he's making the right move and not recertifying it. It's not a stamp of approval that he likes the deal. It's a stamp of approval that everyone's following the agreement, and that makes it much more harder for someone, even if you don't like it, to get out of it. I think the reality of governing, the reality of what it means to take over things that have been agreed upon by someone else, sunk in a little for Donald Trump in these last 7 months, and he's realizing that as much as he wanted to criticize it, it's not something he can just quickly get out of.
What does it mean for U.S. relations with Iran in this space that, you know, we're hearing different opinions on what this deal means from the commander-in-chief?
I think it's going to be difficult. I think we already knew that Trump becoming president was going to make relations with Iran much more difficult than they were under Barack Obama. You know, we have an example to look to, and that's North Korea. President Clinton signed a deal with North Korea right before he left. President Bush came in and sort of nullified the deal immediately, determined that North Korea wasn't following any of the provisions of it. And since then, we've not had any improving relationships with North Korea, and they continue to get worse. And today we learned that they're going to test another, or they're attempting to set up to test another missile. I think that looking at that example, President Obama and the world stage said, we can't let that happen again. We have to figure out a way to do this one differently. That's why it's multilateral. That's why it involves so many other countries. And I think that people are going to say, we don't want to have a North Korea situation again. And they're looking at ways to try to avoid that so that it's not dependent upon a single country in the United States or a single president, Barack Obama or Donald Trump. It's dependent upon a group.
Is there a chance that either country might back out down the road, Iran instead of the U.S., for example?
Yeah, it's very fragile, and I think we know that it's going to remain fragile for a long time. You can't, one deal alone will never be enough to sort of fix what has been a broken relationship for so long. It's going to take a renewed effort over many, many years. And I think we're seeing a little bit of that, but I also think that we're seeing other countries say that if the United States is not prepared to play that role, that there's someone else who can fill the void.
Talking right now with Ginger Gibson. She's a political correspondent at Reuters. She's recapping the top stories in national politics. And we want to hear from you, 800-642-1234. Are you happy with the negotiations President Trump is making and his foreign policy so far? What are your thoughts on how he is reacting to the Iran nuclear deal? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also share your thoughts on Donald Trump Jr.'s unreported meeting with a Russian lawyer that was in the headlines last week and continues to make headlines. Ginger, Donald Trump Jr., this controversy started last week, still ongoing. Donald Trump Jr.'s unreported meeting with a Russian attorney and others. You did some reporting on this. What did you find?
We found that Donald Trump's campaign is picking up the legal bills that are likely to be associated with Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting, investigations into it, in response. They've not confirmed this themselves, but we have public documents that we were able to review that show that Donald Trump's campaign paid $50,000 to Donald Jr.'s lawyer about a week and a half before this story broke. It would be unlikely that they would be paying him to do some other type of work, since that would be a conflict. So it's safe to assume that these things are related. But we do know that what that ultimately means is that the donors, the people who, many of whom are writing $25 and $50 checks to Donald Trump, they're the ones that are paying Jr.'s legal bills.
You also found more than $500,000 to the law firm Jones Day.
That's correct. Jones Day is the law firm that has long represented Donald Trump's campaign. They were hired by him more than a year ago. That was an increase in their payments over the last quarter. But some of that could be the other lawsuits that this campaign is still responding to, still engaged to, and likely to be some of the Russia investigation. This is the campaign's attorney. This is an investigation into the campaign. They are likely being asked to comply by Special Investigator Mueller or by the FBI or by investigative committees in Congress with various requests, things like emails, details of meetings, other background. These attorneys are having to do that work, and that's costing the Trump campaign and the Trump donors a good deal of money.
So the president and Donald Trump Jr. continue to deny any collusion with Russia, but will this revelation add more to the ongoing Russia investigation?
I don't think in the investigation itself, we have to remember what's really important is that it is perfectly legal for the campaign to pay all of these legal offenses. The law says that they may use campaign funds to pay any expenses that wouldn't have arisen had the person not been a candidate or not worked for a candidate. And for that reason, this is likely absolutely legal. I'll tell you the one sort of difficult factor it is Donald Jr. was not on the campaign payroll. He wasn't receiving a campaign check. There could have been an argument made by Donald Trump or his campaign that Donald Jr. was not acting in his capacity as an employee of the campaign, that he was acting on his own. That would seem to put that argument completely to rest. Once the campaign starts paying his legal fees, it seems that, they're quite willing to say that he is a member of the campaign and was working in a campaign capacity.
Another topic as we wrap up here, you wrote about some silent opposition to the Trump administration's policy on steel this week. What's the latest there on steel tariffs?
Yeah, the administration is weighing what's called Section 232 steel tariffs. It would be declaring the importing of steel to be a national security issue and imposing new taxes as a result on imported steel. But a lot of companies stood up and said to the Trump administration that they thought that was a bad idea, that it would drive up costs and that it would make America less competitive and risk manufacturing jobs. We still don't have a decision yet from this administration. It's expected at any time. And we know that the internal debate is really heated with people on both sides. But we know that some of those companies might have at least convinced them to delay a decision, wait a little longer, and give a little more thought to what it could mean to American manufacturers.
Yeah, and we know there is some infighting within the Trump administration about whether to tax steel imports. And we also know that the Commerce Department is supposed to come out with its ruling or its decision perhaps sometime this week. Why is there infighting in the Trump administration about steel?
This is one of the many things that embodies sort of the deep philosophical divisions, the populist arm, maybe led by Steve Bannon, see steel tariffs as a way to protect America, from imports, from Chinese business, from people that want to do harm. And it reinforces a sort of protectionist mentality about our economy.
And I'm going to have to stop it there. Thank you so much, Ginger. That was Ginger Gibson, political correspondent at Reuters, joining us for our Week in Washington segment when we recap the top stories in national politics.
State Senate Republicans released a budget proposal yesterday aimed at solving Wisconsin's budget stalemate. One of the biggest sticking points in current budget negotiations is transportation funding. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Governor Scott Walker both support more borrowing to cover more road costs, but Assembly Leader Robin Voss wants more revenue streams.
We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin should fund transportation projects? What would you like to see in terms of road spending in the state budget? What kinds of ideas would you like to see lawmakers consider? Toll roads, raising the gas tax, perhaps heavy vehicle fees? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ernst Ulrich Franzen joins us now. He's an associate editor of the opinions page at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ernie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
Well, Ernie, we have a Republican in the governor's house. We have Republicans in control of the Senate and the Assembly, and yet we still don't have agreement on how to solve the issue of transportation spending. So how bad could this look for Republicans?
Well, Scott Fitzgerald said it himself. The Senate Majority Leader said last month that we'll all have egg on our face. Republicans will look like we don't know what we're doing if we are somehow through July to August and we don't even have a state budget. He's right. They're going to look pretty silly if they control all the levers of power and they still can't get a budget passed. The sticking point, obviously, well, at least the biggest sticking point, I think, is on transportation. And the sticking point there is that the governor and Fitzgerald want to borrow and delay. And I think the governor's latest proposal was for $300 million in borrowing. The Senate is at $700 million, I think. While Robin Voss over in the Assembly says, no, we're not going to do that. We need to develop revenue streams so we can pay for that borrowing.
And that
Go ahead.
Yeah, you said that $300 million figure from the governor has come down some, as has the number from Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald also come down to $712 million. Is that going to help any?
I am not at this point. They met today. The governor, Fitzgerald, and Voss met today, and nothing much seemed to happen. Voss came out of that meeting and said we didn't get very deep into it, and he was pretty negative on the Senate proposal for yesterday's proposal. So I think they're still sort of stuck.
Now, Fitzgerald had said, I think it was yesterday, that, you know what, we may have to raise the gas tax or vehicle registration fees in the future, maybe not now. Do you think that is sort of throwing a bones to members of the Assembly who say, okay, well, maybe it's not going to be this budget cycle, but maybe Fitzgerald is indicating that down the road there would be some flexibility, and that could be enough to pacify some members of the Assembly like Speaker Voss?
Yeah, maybe. And I don't think that Voss is going to get his way. I think he said earlier that, you know, if it's him against the governor is going to win. So I don't think Voss will get what he wants, and that may be a bone that he can take back to his membership, and they can go with that. But it's still, you know, it's still kicking the can down the road, and you've got serious problems in the roads, in maintaining the roads, in maintaining roads and bridges, in building new lanes, in providing transit. You don't have enough money right now to cover that stuff. So at some point, and if you want to kick it down another 2 years, that's going to be even more problematic. At some point, you have to come up with revenue streams. You've got freeways that are deteriorating, ending there at the end of their life. You've got serious roads, local road situations. At the same time, your revenue is going down because you have, and this will get worse as more fuel-efficient cars come on the market and hybrids and all that stuff. You've got a lot of people paying less in gas taxes and registration fees. So, I mean, that's not a perfect storm, maybe, but it's pretty close.
Why do you think the governor in particular has been so reluctant to do things like to raise the gas tax or raise vehicle registration fees? Does he have his eye on the election, do you think?
Sure. I mean, he's always got to sign the election, I think. But his sort of mantra has been, I'm not going to raise taxes. And that's what he's adhering to that. And, I mean, you can criticize him for that, but that is his stance, and he's standing by it, and voters like it. But, you know, I'm not sure that's a realistic approach when you've got a problem like this.
You've suggested that it could be that Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald and the governor may be waiting, hoping for some kind of federal money to come down the pike and sort of save the day. Do you think that's likely to happen?
It's possible. Trump has President Trump has proposed an infrastructure budget and. But that's not going anywhere right now. They're still stuck on health care. So I don't know that there's a quick fix coming. I also don't know that it's a long-term fix to address the issues that I mentioned a few minutes ago. So they may be thinking, we're going to get help from the feds and everything will be fine. But even that, again, I think is a short-term solution.
We're talking to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ernst Ulrich Franzen right now about the transportation funding stalemate in Wisconsin right now. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Now, another kind of down-the-road solution in a future that isn't right now has been, Ernie, that maybe future generations will be more willing to accept higher fees and to raise the gas tax, but we're not really living in that moment right now. And this is something else that we've heard, I think, from Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. Is there something there that maybe this is not the moment, but the moment may come later?
Maybe. But now there's a survey out from the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. And, you know, admittedly, they're for raising taxes to pay for roads. or at least raising their fees and taxes to provide the revenue stream. But according to their survey, their poll that they did, voters don't want to borrow. They want legislators to find a long-term solution on transportation. 73% of voters and 69% of voters who said they were Republican said that. They want a long-term solution over increased bonding and using general purpose revenues. 83% said it should be a pay-as-you-go system, and a supermajority said that, only 5% said that they were willing to go to borrowing for their to fund transportation projects, and most of them said they're okay with modest hikes in the gas tax and registration fees to pay for this. In addition, more than 550 local units of government have passed resolutions encouraging lawmakers to provide the resources they need, and the local governments have been hit by cuts in state funding, so they are less able to maintain their roads. So now this budget, as I understand at the beginning at least, provided more money for the locals to do that, but it's still trying to catch up to a backlog that's pretty severe.
Got a caller on the line now. Let's take John with us from Janesville. John, hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
They just keep saying that they're going to do this bill and it will lower taxes to the rich people, and this bill will lower more taxes to the rich, and if they get the health care thing through, it will lower the taxes to the rich by $1 trillion. Why don't they just keep it the same and pay for the roads with the money that they were going to lower to the rich people?
John, thank you for that call. And, you know, some different budget negotiations going on at the federal level and the state level. But what about that overarching sentiment that John has there, that it's time to raise taxes on those with higher incomes?
Or keep them the same. I mean, they're... But again, Walker is committed to not raising taxes at all. So he doesn't want the fees to go up. He doesn't want gas tax to go up, even though it hasn't gone up in a long time, and even though neighboring states pay more for gas taxes than we do. So, sure, they could do that. They could do a bunch of things, but they're not willing, at least the governor is not willing, to make those moves.
John, thanks.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You just want to go back to the voters and say, I told you I wouldn't raise your taxes, but I had to do in this case. No. He doesn't want to do that.
John, thanks a lot for the call. And Jackie has some ideas. Jackie's in Deerfield. Jackie, hello.
Hi. I am calling, wondering about the possibility of separating the transportation budget from the general budget for the purpose of setting up a binding referendum. I believe that the cost of gas has gone down so much in the last couple of years that most people in this state would not find it a great hardship to raise gas tax 5 cents. Our governor is unwilling to raise any taxes, but
right.
Is he unwilling to raise the taxes if it is a mandate of his constituents?
Jackie, thanks. Good questions. What about that, Ernie?
Yeah, that is a good question. A few years ago, and this does go back a few years, I'm not sure exactly when, but there was a referendum in Milwaukee County for a local sales tax to pay for transit and parks and some other issues. Voters approved that. It wasn't overwhelming approval, but they did approve it, and nothing ever happened. The state did not, in order for the county to do that, the state would have had to come in and give them permission. It didn't happen. So if a majority of voters would come out and say, we're willing to pay more in a referendum, even then I'm not sure the governor would yield on this.
Right now, we're talking with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ernst Ulrich Franzen, talking about the transportation funding stalemate active right now in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you about what you think at 800-642-1234. What ideas do you think should be on the table when it comes to paying for Wisconsin's roads? What do you think about things like raising the gas tax, implementing toll roads, or charging different user fees? What about borrowing to cover transportation funding? Or how would you like to see lawmakers solve the current budget impasse? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and get to more of your calls in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're picking up our discussion with Ernst Ulrich Franzen from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's editorial page about transportation funding in Wisconsin and the current budget stalemate.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin should fund transportation? What kind of plan would you like to see lawmakers include in the state budget? How do you feel about borrowing to pay for transportation funding here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go back to our callers now. We've got Will on the line with us in Windsor. Hi, Will.
Hey, good afternoon. And Ernst, I love your columns, and I guess I'm politically right where you are, and to kind of reinforce the things I think. Somebody called in earlier about raising the gas tax because gas prices are low, and it really wouldn't make that much difference, especially when you see gas prices fluctuate. But I think another source of revenue, too, is farms. Farms receive gasoline tax credits and are exempt from paying the taxes on the fuel that's used. And that's for farm machinery, for farm trucks. Where does it stop with the private use of vehicles and so on? But it's something that really should be looked at, especially since farm vehicles are on the roads quite a bit too, and they're huge and destroy the roads and destroy the shoulders, mess up the roads quite a bit.
Will, got your point there about taking a closer look at farms, farm vehicles, and some of the exemptions they're enjoying. Should that be given a second look, Ernie?
Sure. I mean, that's worth a second look. I haven't looked much into that myself, but that's certainly a good idea. There was a proposal for a heavy truck fee within the last few weeks. That died a quick death. But that, too, with heavier vehicles like farm vehicles and like heavy trucks, caused more wear and tear on the roads than regular vehicles. So charging those users more because they wear down the roads more makes some sense to me.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up, and we're going to go next to Rick in Nakusa. Rick, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I guess I'm opposed to borrowing money to fix the problem. It really doesn't fix it. It just kind of actually increases the, the long-term cost of the roads. I think we shot ourselves in the foot in 2000 when the gas tax was frozen, whereas before it had been indexed to inflation. So we've been kind of digging a hole for ourselves the last 7 or 8 years. I personally would be willing to pay more in gas tax. I agree with the caller that earlier said, gas prices are so low now that if you increased the gas tax to fix the roads, and I think constitutionally that money has to be used for that purpose, I don't think motorists would be opposed to that. And then I guess my question to the guest is, how much would gas taxes have to be raised in order to pay for the shortfall?
Okay, Rick, I don't know the answer to that one. Ernie, what do you think? Do we have a number?
I don't have a number, but it's a good question. Would a nickel do it? I don't know. I'd have to check that out. I'm not sure how much would have to be raised. But with a combination, I mean, we have said that it should be a combination of a modest hike in the gas tax, modest hikes in the registration fees, things like the heavy truck fee. Maybe toll roads should be on the table, although that's never flown real high in Wisconsin, flown real well in Wisconsin. There are some systems for vehicle miles traveled
That's a possibility, although I'm not sure that would catch tourism dollars, you know, tourists who come here in their cars. I don't know how much it would cost to, how much you would need to raise to cover the deficit. I mean, it's a big deficit and it's a big problem. So I don't know that a hike that drivers would accept, and they would accept some hike, would cover the whole thing. And as to your caller's point about not borrowing, Senate Republicans, our reporter Patrick Marley has a story on the website right now that talks about in 2015, November 2015, Alberta Darling was saying, we're not going to kick the can down the road, talking about borrowing for roads. Senator Howard Markline of Spring Green said, I do not believe we should be going further into debt when we haven't created any new sources of revenue to make the payments on this new debt. Now they're both voting for this package because they don't think they can raise the revenue.
Well, Rick, thanks a lot for bringing that up. And let's take another call on this topic now from Carol in Green Bay. Carol, hi.
Hi. I would like to say that I am in favor of us raising the gas tax and also some kind of a wheel tax if need be. I'd even be open to toll roads, but I wouldn't know where to put those. But I don't think we can continue to go getting further and further into debt because we have such a large debt already. It just gets worse as we go, and we can't leave this for our grandchildren. I think Governor Walker is not willing to raise taxes because he said he wouldn't, and he's afraid it'll affect his reelection. And it might, but because President H.W. Walker didn't win when he changed his mind on taxes. But I still think the people would be in favor of this in general.
Carol, thank you for that, saying we can't pass it on to the next generation, passed it on long enough. And I'm curious what you think, Ernie. Right now we're at this stalemate position, and obviously, you know, someone has to bend. Eventually there has to be some sort of compromise maybe reached for things to move forward. But, you know, if things drag on, if things get more and more acrimonious, and maybe if there's borrowing when it's not in favor with constituents, who ends up taking the fall for this?
Good question. I don't know. A lot of it obviously will depend on what the final form is. If you keep on going into August without a budget, though, obviously the governor's going to take a hit. Fitzgerald's going to take a hit. And Voss will, too, because he is being painted in some circles as the obstructionist on this whole thing. Maybe Voss, because he will, you know, he's seen as the obstructionist, and the others will say, well, we can borrow this. And our columnist Christian Schneider said that the governor had offered a good proposal with $300 million of borrowing, and it's time to get this done, and Voss should knuckle under to the governor and do that, which is, I mean, it's sort of an odd thing. I understand the point. I understand the point, and Christian's a smart guy and a good guy, but it's an odd thing for a conservative to say, let's borrow and kick this can down the road.
And so given that you said you think that it sounds like it's Robin Voss maybe has the most to lose in terms of being seen as an obstructionist, is that the mm-hmm. scenario you think that eventually unfolds? I mean, it's hard to see into a crystal ball here, but do you think that that seems like the most likely scenario here?
Maybe, but he's going to make sure that, and he's going to be very vocal about it, I'm assuming, that this problem is not solved, and that the governor and Fitzgerald in the Senate have not addressed the problem. He's going to make sure that people understand that. So I think everybody on the Republican side, as Fitzgerald said, will end up with egg on their face, and it'll look like the Republicans aren't very good at governing.
And we'll leave it there. Ernie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for your time.
That was Ernst Ulrich Franzen, Associate Opinions Editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And he was with us today to talk about his recent editorial about transportation funding in Wisconsin. Obviously, you have a lot to say about it. You can let us know what you think, share your thoughts. Are you in favor of borrowing, putting this off a little more, or about raising maybe the gas tax? Let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. Thank you. This Monday marked World Emoji Day, and to celebrate, Apple just announced that they'll be releasing new emojis for iOS 11 for those moments when words fail us and only a picture of a coconut will do.
That's right. In fact, a coconut is one of the new emojis announced by Apple, along with a bearded guy, an elf, and an exploding head.
Right, an exploding head, and in a good way, kind of like that blew my mind. And there's also a woman in a headscarf, a breastfeeding emoji, and a barf emoji, which will have many applications, I'm sure. And I guess, yeah, sometimes emojis really just say it all.
I'm wondering when our world will be wordless and we'll just function with emojis.
Oh, it might save some time. So we'll be doing our scripts in zebra, zombie, T-Rex, exploding head, and elf.
You never know. Emojis are a big hit with my kids.
Which emoji do you use the most, Kate? Do you have a favorite?
Well, I just love all the different smiley faces.
Yeah.
And they just always, you know, a little bit of a pick-me-up.
I use a lot of hearts and fireworks in mine.
Yeah, that's
good. Emojis say a lot. They're the window to the soul.
Very deep.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.